Hurry up and get well. We need men like you out there.
Today on the podcast, very special guest. I've got the New York Times best-selling author of Lee Marvin, Point Blank, the new book, Killing Generals, The Making of the Dirty Dozen, the most iconic World War II movie of all time. Folks, it is Dwayne Epstein. Dwayne, welcome to Fanacek, man. Thanks for doing this.
Fanacek, thank you for having me. Appreciate
it. Yeah, man. I am really excited about this. So I've had several authors on the show, and what I love to do is I love to get the book, read the book, make sure I know what I'm talking about. And it's always a pleasure when I genuinely enjoy the book. And I really enjoyed your book. I was familiar with the movie, but I did a rewatch anyway, just so it helped me enjoy the book a little bit more. So my first question was, obviously, you know, the previous book was Lee Marvin, Point Blank. Then you got this book. So I'm going to go ahead. I'm sure you've heard this quote a million times. Probably people throw it to you all the time. But I'm going to go ahead and quote Mr. Blonde from Reservoir Dogs and say, I bet you're a big Lee Marvin fan, huh?
Me too. I love that guy. I love that. I love that line.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me, why Lee Marvin? Why the Dirty Dozen? How'd that? What's the genesis there?
Well, there's a story on both projects. One of them, I'll start first with the story of Lee Marvin, Point Blank. How that came about. I had made friends with a gentleman by the name of Marshall Terrell, who had written a wonderful bio on Steve McQueen, of whom I'm a huge fan. And I met with him and we talked. And when we talked, he said to me, you know, you should write your own biography. You know movies really well. And we started to discuss different subjects. And most of the actors I'm a really, really big fan of have already had pretty decent biographies written about them. The one that seemed to have slipped through the rabbit hole was Lee Marvin. There had never been a book written about, well, there had been, but I don't really like disparaging other authors. It could have been better.
Got it.
That meant there wasn't really a good bio available on Lee Marvin. And I then spent literally the next 20 years, that's how long it took,
wow,
both researching and attempting to get it published. And it finally did in 2013. By Tim Schaffner of Schaffner Press. And when I was attempting to get it published all those years, I was constantly being told there's no market for Lee Marvin. Nobody remembers him. Nobody really cares. Well, what wound up happening was when Tim Schaffner published Lee Marvin, Point Blank, it eventually went to number 4 on the New York Times bestsellers list.
That's so wild.
Yeah, I was very, very pleased by that.
I bet.
Unfortunately, not long after that, a couple of years after that, my literary agent, a super, super guy by the name of Mike Hamelberg, he passed away. So I was kind of in free fall. And then a couple of years after that, I was approached by a gentleman named Lee Sobel, who was a literary agent. And he asked me if I need an agent. And I said, that's kind of I'm not familiar with this being done this way. I was always looking for an agent. I've never had an agent come looking for me.
Right.
And he said to me, why are authors so cynical? I get that from all these authors all the time. And I went, well, let me think about it. So I checked him out. Turns out he wasn't only legit, but he was very good at his job. So we talked and he asked me what I wanted to write about. And I had attempted a biography of Charles Bronson, but that's a long story and it didn't come to pass. But in any event, he asked me, are there any movies you'd like to write about? So I said, yeah, I'd like to write about The Dirty Dozen. It's probably my favorite Lee Marvin movie. And he said, put a proposal together and I will submit it. And this is not an exaggeration. In about 2 weeks' time, after I gave it to him and he submitted it to a publisher, they accepted it. And there it is.
Nice, man. Yeah, I've got my copy here.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So
that's how it happened.
Excellent. Well, the movie, obviously based on by E.M. Nathanson, mm-hmm. There seems to be some debate. I'm curious what your thoughts are on whether or not this is based on a true story.
It absolutely is not. That okay. I can tell you.
Fair enough.
And it's funny, too, because the author himself, of whom I was able to get, he passed away, I believe, in 2013, Ian Nathanson. But a friend of mine had done an interview with him, and she gave it to me. It was an unpublished interview. Her name is Beverly Gray. Wonderful writer herself, by the way. And in the interview, that's one of the things he talked about was the fact that people were always not asking him if there really was a Dirty Dozen, but more importantly, after the movie came out, he was being contacted by complete strangers saying, I'm one of the Dirty Dozen,
right,
or I flew the plane that dropped the paratrooping Dirty Dozens into, behind the lines in Germany. And anytime he pursued any of those comments, turned out not to be true. So in all fairness, there's a certain amount of truth in what was in Ian Nathanson's novel based on the research that he did. He did a hell of a lot of research for a couple of years. But basically what he decided to do was take the original story and fictionalize it. And what he did was use the research information he had uncovered through military records, trial transcripts, of men who had been during World War II tried for murder and rape and other violent crimes, and used that to write the book, which was about 500 pages long. I should tell you too, there's an interesting backstory about how he came up with the idea. It came from the strangest of places. Nathanson was friends and neighbors with a gentleman by the name of Russ Meyer. And if you've ever, Russ Meyer, exactly.
Yeah.
The same one, the king of sexploitation.
Yeah, sexploitation movies, yeah.
Anyway, he was just happened to have a conversation with McNathanson one night, and just happened to mention, based on what they were talking about, Russ Meyer said, "That reminds me of the Dirty Dozen." And Nathanson said, "What are you talking about?" And he proceeded to tell him, because during the war, Russ Meyer was a combat photographer, and he was assigned to Patton, of all people, and a unit that was under Patton's command. And he had been ordered to take photos of these 12 convicts in London that were under arrest for violent crimes, and they were being trained for a suicide mission behind enemy lines. And when he took pictures of them, and he turned it in to his commanding officer, and if it's for me, I'm not here.
I apologize. It's so unprofessional.
No, that's okay.
Go ahead.
And he went back to find out what happened to the Dirty Dozen. And the guy who had initially told him to take the photo said, they all died in the mission. They're gone. So then he went back to his CO to find out what happened to the footage he took. And it went through all these different units and levels command. And apparently nobody knows. Now, Nathanson was very firm in saying, I don't believe Russ made the story up. What he told me, he believed. However, this is the term that Nathanson himself used. He called it most likely a latrine rumor. And he also added that once Russ Meyer told him the story of the so-called Dirty Dozen, Nathanson said, the hackles on the back of my neck went up. He said, this is an amazing story. This is a story that really needs to be told. Now, I'd like to add, too, and I put it in the intro of the book, that although the U.S. military has never, ever, ever used convicted criminals in combat or for any kind of mission or training or what have you, I don't even know if it was ever considered. However, other armies did. The Nazis during World War II opened up their prisons and trained a bunch of criminals to kill in, I believe, Yugoslavia, because the Yugoslavian nationals, partisans, were pushing the Nazis back. And so they decided, let's not lose any more Nazis. Let's lose a bunch of convicts instead. Right. Also, too, as recently as like a year ago, the Russians are doing the same thing with convicts in their prisons to fight in the Ukraine. I mean, it's pretty bizarre. I mean, the movie came out over 50 years ago, and the book even longer than that. But yet, that mentality of trying to train bad guys to do good things, at least for their side, that still exists. But the Dirty Dozen never did, I should say.
Gotcha. Now, the movie came out in 67.
Yep.
One thing I thought was interesting, had this movie come out several years earlier, there was a chance John Wayne was going to be the lead, right? Over Lee Marvin?
Well, actually, he was approached. John Wayne was approached. And he gave several reasons why he would not want to do it. And it's interesting that it did come out in 67, mainly because that was a sea change in American cinema, in that the studio system had crumbled. The production code was about to go through a major overhaul that in the following year, in 68, they would implement that rating system of, you know, G, PG, M, R, X, all of that. But at the time the film came out, it was still in flux. Now, John Wayne turned it down because he read the script and, excuse me, I'm nursing a cold, forgive me. He sent a memo to the film's producer, Ken Hyman, that I found rather humorous. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm a fan of John Wayne's film, most of his films, not all. But in the memo he sent Ken Hyman, he said, whoever wrote this screenplay, okay, is more than likely a sandal-wearing, long-haired college student carrying a sign protesting the war he should be fighting himself.
Wow.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, here's the thing. The screenplay he read was written by a 66-year-old Oscar-winning veteran of screenwriting.
Right.
A gentleman named Nunley Johnson, who won the Oscar for writing the screenplay of Grapes of Wrath.
Right.
Now, that's why John Wayne turned it down. He didn't think his audience would want to see him incinerating a bunch of Nazis and their women. He thought the film's point of view was rather anti-military and anti-American, and wasn't necessarily wrong about that. What he wound up doing instead was making the Green Berets.
Interesting. Complete opposite.
Yeah, which was exactly right. Now, when Lee Marvin was approached to play the lead, Major Reisman, he liked it. He liked the idea of incinerating a bunch of Nazis. And he told the producer, Ken Hyman, he said, actually, he didn't say it to Ken Hyman, but he let it be known in an interview when he was asked about the violence perpetrated against perceived civilians. Now, to my mind, any prostitute to a Nazi, I don't think is really that much of a civilian, but that's just me. He had said, let's not kid ourselves. War is violent. Civilians get killed in every war imaginable. And he cited the example of the bombing of Dresden. And if you wanted to go further, he could have included the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mean, it's a known fact. Innocent people die in war. They shouldn't, and it's a tragedy. But then again, war in and of itself is a tragedy.
Sure.
And that's one of the things that Lee Marvin liked about it. Overall, you know, it's been said that Marvin didn't like the Dirty Dozen. That's another urban rumor. That's not true. He thought the premise was ridiculous of training 12 convicts for a suicide mission. But how the story was done and where the story went and his character and the belief that war in and of itself is madness, he liked that. He liked that a lot. And consequently, it wound up being the biggest financial hit film of his career.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it made him number one at the box office in 1967.
Now, was I'm curious, this is an honest question. I'm not trying to debate. Which came first, chicken or the egg, in the sense that was the movie kind of, did the movie have an anti-war message, or the fact that it came out in 1967, was it seen through the lens of anti-war because now the counterculture is taking part, where reactions to Vietnam? I mean, which kind of came first here?
Well, it's funny. Robert Aldridge, the director, has said many, many times that to his mind, it was kind of a perfect storm in that the movie was released just as the Vietnam War was escalating.
Right.
Johnson was sending more troops. And also the feelings towards the war was beginning to change. It had been going on and escalating for 4 or 5 years. And there was a strong anti-war movement in the country, and that affected the way the film was perceived. And like I said a moment, well, like Robert Aldrich had said, it was a perfect storm. He told a reporter, there is no way we could have known that the war, the feelings about the Vietnam War would change as much as they did by the time the film came out. And more importantly, keep in mind, when the film came out, a good many World War II veterans were still very much alive, and they loved the film. Critics, sure. On the other hand, it was the definition of a mixed reviews. Some loved it. They thought it was brilliant filmmaking. Some hated it. They thought it was pro-war. And those who also hated it thought it was anti-war, and it was rather hypocritical. And one of my favorite quotes was the one from Judith Crist of the, I believe it was either the New Yorker, who had said, Robert Aldrich figured it out. War is madness. And if you want war to be fought, bring in psychopaths. That's how it's got to work. So there was a point to be made. I don't know if it really can be considered anti-war, because I have the feeling if you're going to show a lot of combat scenes in a war movie, it's not really going to be anti-war. However, sure. It certainly was anti-military. It had a very strong point of view that everybody in charge, in fact, one of Lee Marvin's best lines in the film is early on when he gets told what the mission is and who he's going to have to train. Marvin tells Ernest Borgnine, his commanding officer, I don't think it's a good idea to let it be known that somebody that we're working for is a raving lunatic.
Right.
You know, the guy who came up with the plan, which, by the way, they never say.
Yeah, they never tell you. Yeah.
Yeah.
But another interesting thing, too, in this is, and it's something that I honestly never noticed or thought about till I read the book, was also Jim Brown's character.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Very much like the Muhammad Ali situation, you know.
You betcha. Mm-hmm. One of the things that Robert Aldrich did that upset the original screenwriter, Nunnally Johnson, he had told Ken Hyman when he read Nunnally Johnson's script, he said, you know, this is a really good script for 1945, but this is going to be released in 1967, and we need it to be more current. And so he brought in a screenwriter he had used many, many times, a guy named Lucas Heller, who he revised it. There was about 3 or 4 revisions, and there were revisions even while the film was being shot in England. And one of the things that got revised was Jim Brown's character. And they wound up putting, I don't even know if it was so much Lucas Heller who put this in, or maybe Robert Aldrich himself, who was also very, very liberal, one of Hollywood's most famous liberals, and a tough guy and a maverick. And one of the things that was added was when Lee Marvin is interviewing Jim Brown about going on the mission, Lee Marvin tries to convince him by saying, you know, the Nazis, you know, they're the real master race merchants. And then Jim Brown tells him, that's your war, Major, not mine. You want to kill German Krauts, you go right ahead. I'll pick my enemies.
Sure.
It's almost identical in different words to what Muhammad Ali said when he didn't want to serve in Vietnam. And he fought against it. And what he did was he told reporters, pardon my saying it, but this is a direct quote. He said, no Viet Cong ever called me a nigger.
Right. No, for
sure. So it's the same point of view. And they were smart to put that in there because the civil rights movement was very, very was growing very strong at the time.
Sure.
And I mentioned that in the book about some of the riots that were taking place, the demonstrations. So you had the civil rights movement. You had political upheaval going on based the next year on the Democratic Convention in Chicago. You had the anti-war movement. You had all this stuff going on at the same time, and all of it could be seen to a certain extent in the Dirty Dozen. So if you were a hawk at that time period, you could have liked the movie a lot because it was a good old-fashioned combat film. Right. If you were a dove, they were showing your point of view. War is madness. I don't want to be involved in this. And, you know, all these other things came together to make it the hit that it was. It wound up being, out of all the great movies that came out that year, and it was an amazing year for filmmaking. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Cool Hand Luke, Bonnie and Clyde, just all these really, truly great. Oh, In the Heat of the Night, the number one film at the box office, Oh, The Graduate. The number one film at the box office was The Dirty Dozen.
Right.
And at the time, I think it's still pretty high, but at the time, it was the sixth highest grossing film in MGM's history.
Oh, wow.
And as Ian Nathanson said at the time, he goes, and because MGM wasn't doing that well financially, it's that movie saved MGM's ass.
Sure.
Pure and simple.
And so it was a long shoot, an over budget shoot. Didn't it go almost like twice as long? I mean, it seemed like it was pretty arduous.
Yes, it was on both levels. It was very expensive and it was way over schedule. Something that really upset Robert Aldridge, mainly because he was known, he had a reputation for shooting on time and under budget and under schedule. He was very good at what he did. But the reasons, number one, it was shot entirely in England and the weather didn't cooperate very often. Also, because it was in England, the way the laws worked at that time, he wasn't allowed to use his regular crew, which was an American crew. He could in post-production when he came back to this country, but in terms of the camera crew and the sound crew and all that, they were all British. And he was used to doing about 10 to 15 setups a day, doing, you know, shooting 10 to 15 different scenes a day, going fast, not the Brits.
Yeah.
When he was dealing with the British crew for whatever, and by the way, this British crew had worked with American filmmakers before. His cinematographer had worked a lot with John Huston, who filmed in Europe. Now, they were shooting two or three setups a day. It was driving him nuts, and he hated it. Also, too, that wonderful chateau that was built at the end of the film, okay? No CGI. It wasn't animated. It was real. The art and set director did too good of a job. They built almost, you know, at least in the facade anyway, a real chateau. And it was done so well that they found out it would have taken about 200 tons of dynamite to blow it up.
Wow.
200 tons.
Right.
They had to tear down the middle and redo it with, like balsa wood and other softer items. So at the very least, when they used the dynamite to blow it up, the explosive to blow it up, it'll look real and it would, you know, blow up the midsection. So it looks like the whole thing blew up. Wound up using instead 10 tons of dynamite, not 200. So, I mean, these were the things that, you know, delayed the budget, delayed the schedule that Robert Aldridge grappled with, that Ken Hyman, the producer, grappled with. And it was also the reason why Jim Brown quit the NFL.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because he didn't go back.
No, he didn't. Matter of fact, he held a press conference in the middle of the film and let everybody know, I'm not coming back. I'm done. Because he was given an ultimatum by the owner of the Cleveland Browns saying, if you're not back on a certain date, we're going to fine you $100 a day. And he later said, too, $100 a day. That's lunch money.
Right.
But the very fact that he got an ultimatum really pissed off Jim Brown. So the very next day, he held a press conference on the set of the movie saying, you know, I wanted to come back, but the movie's over schedule. And so I am retiring from the NFL. He was only 29 years old.
Right.
And what happened was, you can't buy publicity like that. That's like people would see that in the news media and go, ooh, what's this movie Jim Brown thinks is worthy of quitting the NFL for? How good is it? How bad is it? Let's see. Let's find out. Certainly that helped add to the box office appeal.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, getting back to that chateau too, they built a river.
Yep. Yes, they did.
That's insane.
And what's funny is when they shot that scene where they actually blew up the chateau, they were, what was it, about 30 miles outside of London where it was filmed. It was filmed out in the country, so somewhere in London. And they were getting calls from all over the country and the county and the city. Is somebody invading us? Is there a war on? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Everybody thought it was real.
Right.
That lived nearby. So
yeah, I guess it's no joke in Europe when they have had wars fought on their soil.
That's right. And when they were invaded by guys in Nazi uniforms, and in some instances, Americans fighting the Nazis back.
Sure.
One of the things that was also a problem was that when they were filming, they were billeted in London, but they would have to drive 30 miles to where the film was being shot. And that meant all this equipment, all these trucks, the camera trucks and all this kind of stuff. And they had to ride through a certain village that before that the filming was going to take place, and it's got locations, what have you, that particular village wanted to get an award for the most well-kept village in all of England. Well, that got thrown out the window once the truck started coming in. And so Ken Hyman, out of his own pocket from MGM, he had to pay to have it all cleaned up.
Right.
So, this is the kind of stuff that happens in filmmaking, but it was just interesting to me that this all happened specifically to the Dirty Dozen. And you would think, too, with the cast of characters and actors that were involved in the making of the film, that there would have been a lot more fireworks, in terms of the way they all got along.
Yeah, let's talk about that, yeah.
Yeah, I was surprised to find out, there was, but it was minimal at best. I mean, they actually all got along.
Yeah,
for the most part. Ken Hyman told me, whom I interviewed, by the way, Ken Hyman told me that you could see it on the first day of rehearsal. When they all showed up and they were around this big, long table, which is a photo I have in the book of that, which is great. And Clint Walker called it the Knights of the Round Table. They were on a big green felt table with bound copies of the script, and they were going through it. And Ken Hyman said, you can see these guys becoming the characters on the very first day. It was just magical, the chemistry and the way they gelled. Now, on occasion, they didn't always get along. My favorite example is like on the first day, they had a military advisor telling, the cast, the instruction for when they're supposed to march through the prison is dress right. Mm-hmm. When they go arm's length and they turn their head, okay? Yep. Charles Bronson said, look, I was in the Army Air Corps. It's not dressed right. It's right dress. Lee Marvin, who had been a Marine in the Pacific during World War II, said, you don't know what you're talking about, Charlie. It's dressed right. And they started arguing back and forth.
Right.
Until finally, Robert Aldridge, who's at the head of the table, he waited long enough to find the right moment. And apparently, he was a big man, stocky, or in a less polite realm, overweight. He stuck his head between the two of them while they were arguing, and he went, I don't care if it's right dress or dress right. You do it the way we effing tell you to do it. Now, shut up.
Right.
And they both backed down. Now, we're talking Charles Bronson and Lee Marvin here.
Sure. Well, that's what you need in that director, because that's a lot of egos to manage,
Oh, big
time. You're talking about Cassavetes, a director, and he probably had his own opinions on everything. And there was a lot of big egos in that room.
You bet. Ken Hyman told me, and that's another thing, I was lucky enough to interview Ken Hyman, and that was not an easy thing to do because he was nowhere to be found. He had long since retired to England. He was not in the Producers Guild anymore, and there was no way to find him via any internet websites or guilds. But I had found out by doing some of the paper research I did, he was married to a lady named Carolyn Hyman. Now, I don't even know if they were still together or what, or if he was even still alive, but I checked out all the Carolyn Hymans possible on the internet, and I found one that was a photographer of animals in England. And I asked her, are you by any chance married to the former film producer, Ken Hyman? And she said, yes, I am. And we went from there. And as I like to tell people, how come there's no Jewish detectives? I was very proud of myself for finding him. And I called him, he got on the phone. I said, hello, Mr. Hyman. My name is Dwayne Epstein, and I'm researching a book on the making of the Dirty Dozen. First thing he says to me is, please, Dwayne, call me Ken. I went, okay, Mr. Hyman. And he said, listen, you call me Mr. Hyman one more time, I'm going to hang up this phone. And I was like, cool. This is a cool guy. I like this guy. And he proceeded to tell me a great story. He also helped me because he had a wonderful memory. He's in his 90s, but he remembered things with crystal clarity. He helped me discover a lot of things that were said about that movie that's not true. One of them being, and it's still being said today, and I don't know why, that Robert Aldridge would have gotten an Oscar nomination for Best Director if he'd have changed the ending of the film and not make it so violent. And I asked Ken Hyman about that, and Ken Hyman said, I've been hearing that for years, and that's just not true. It just isn't. Robert Aldridge didn't get an Oscar nomination because the Academy hates him, and he hates the Academy. He's as anti-Hollywood as you could get. He would never get an Oscar nomination. And as I wrote in the book, Robert Aldridge once famously said, if I made a biblical epic, I wouldn't get an Oscar nomination. And the fact of the matter is he did. The movie was called Sodom and Gomorrah.
Sodom and Gomorrah, yeah.
So those are the kinds of movies Robert Aldridge made.
I love it. So let's go through that cast. I mean, we talk about Lee Marvin, Charles Bronson, John Cassavetes, Jim Brown, we mentioned. Trini Lopez. How about that story in the book? I had no idea he got fired.
Yeah, a lot of
and so I was particularly watching that scene when I rewatched the movie about he's still up in the tree or he got caught up in a tree. That's so funny.
Yeah, right. And you know what's funny is most of the cast didn't know that. When they were going to shoot that scene the next day and they were all in the field and they were going to shoot that night, I don't know who it was who told me. I think it was one of the guys, Colin Maitland, who said, I looked around and I saw 11 of us. And I was thinking, and he goes, and I think, who's missing? What's going on? And then Robert Aldridge walked up to everybody and gave him new pages. And there are several versions of how that came about. Now, I think it's funny that, like you said a moment ago, the powerful egos and the different egos that were involved, apparently, to paraphrase briefly, Ken Hyman told me about John Cassavetes, and he had a hard time getting him to agree to make the movie. He didn't want to. And there was a big legal problem with him doing it. And he finally agreed. And Ken Hyman said, listen, John Cassavetes is a great actor, a great director, terrific writer, but he's a great big pain in the ass to deal with. And then he proceeded to explain how and why. But he was incredible in the movie. Now, with people like that, and Bronson's ego and Marvin's ego and all these others, surprisingly, the biggest diva of the cast was Trini Lopez.
Sure. Because he had a hit song out at the time, right?
Big time. Big time. And rather ironic that the name of the song that we had a hit with was called Lemon Tree. And what Robert Aldridge decided to do was have Jimenez, his character, break his neck in the parachute jump in an apple tree.
Yeah. And you know, it works. I know it was spur of the moment, but it really works because that's right at the start of the mission. So it kind of sets this ominous tone of, wow, we just got here and we're already down one man. It kind of works.
Exactly right. And I thought it was a brilliant movie. And there are several versions of how that came about. One of my favorites was when Telly Savalas told a friend that because Trini Lopez himself admitted in the DVD commentary that he didn't like making the movie. He had never been in the service, so he didn't like having to carry a 40-pound pack on his back and having to run down the hill. And he didn't like it. Sure. And so when he started whining and complaining as much as he did, Telly Savalas told a friend that after one day shooting, Robert Aldridge walked off the location, walked over to the writer who was on set, pointed to Trini Lopez and went, kill him. and Donald Sutherland said that after he was, and by the way, there were other reasons why Trini Lopez was written out of the film, which is in the book. Donald Sutherland said that a few days after he had been fired, he went back to Robert Aldridge after he had seen some of the footage that they had already shot. And he went up to him and went, Mr. Aldridge, I'd like to come back into the film. And Aldridge said, you're dead, Trini. You can't come back. You're dead. Yeah. And that was it.
Yeah.
He was done.
And so that's a couple people didn't mention. Telly Savalas, obviously, is Maggie, Donald Sutherland, Clint Walker, who we mentioned earlier. So when I saw this movie as a kid, first of all. So did I. Yeah. And I was always taken by, and again, I think as a Kojak, I always loved Telly Savalas.
Right.
So someone as a kid, and then I saw it probably a couple of years ago. And again, I was really, you know, of course, Lee Marvin and Charles Bronson, they're just cool in this movie. They're like the two tough guys, you know, because even Clint Walker, well, he's kind of proven as not being all that tough when Lee Marvin whoops up on him. But in my rewatch of it, for me, this recent time, when I watched it about a week ago in preparation of talking to you, the two actors that really stuck out to me were Cassavetes, who I think got an Oscar nomination.
Yes, he did.
And how great was Donald Sutherland in this? I don't think I ever noticed it before.
I got to interview him, and it was really cool. The handful of people that were alive when I started working on the project, which means I got to interview Clint Walker, wonderful, sweet man. And I interviewed a guy named Bob Phillips, who played a very, very important role in the movie.
He's Lee Marvin's babysitter, right?
Bingo. And boy, did he tell me great stories. Anyway, the thing about Donald Sutherland was, during rehearsal, he was able to, well, everybody did. They were all throwing out ideas about this scene or the other. And Donald Sutherland told me that one big scene he has in the movie made his career. Because what happened was, that was written with Clint Walker in mind. And Clint Walker didn't want to do it, you know, where he's the fake general inspecting the troops.
It would have made more sense with Clint Walker aesthetically. I get that. I mean,
well, that was the idea. But Walker said, because he was playing a character who's supposed to be Native American, he said he thought it would be demeaning of Native Americans. So he didn't want to do it. And then Donald Sutherland said, Robert Aldridge looked across the table, saw me, and said, hey, hey, you with the ears, you do it. and Sutherland added, he goes, I do have rather biggish ears. So he made the most of that scene, and it was great. Now,
it was great. It was so funny.
After the film came out, Robert Altman, about 2 years later, Robert Altman was preparing to do MASH, the film. And Donald Sutherland's agent wanted him to play Hawkeye Pierce in the film. Robert Altman didn't know whether or not Donald Sutherland could do comedy. Donald Sutherland told his agent, send him that scene from The Dirty Dozen. That'll convince him. And it did. And that's how he got MASH. Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting. Yeah, and one of the coolest things
Go ahead, man. One of the coolest things he told me, because I went through the novel, it's over 500 pages, and I disseminated it, and I went through the script that I had a copy of, and I went through the movie several times. Almost all the characters have a background about what they did or why they got arrested, especially in the book, but not the character of Vernon Pinkley. He's such a minor character, Nathanson didn't think to give him a background. So I asked Donald Sutherland, what do you think Vernon Pinkley got arrested and busted for? And Donald Sutherland said, you're right. It's not mentioned in the book or in the script. So I made it up in my own mind. I figured he got arrested for stealing food. And he had done it so much that they wanted to make an example of him. And he said, I had Vernon Pinkley all set inside my eyelids. Behind my brain was a movie screen. And I knew everything he was going to say and do, even if anybody else didn't. And you can see it by the way he plays the character. I thought he was brilliant in it.
Yeah, no, he was great. That's one of my favorite line in that scene when he just pretended to be the general and he asked that kid where he's from. And I forget what the kid said.
Where you from, son? Madison City, Missouri, sir. Never heard of it.
Never heard of it.
It's great.
It's fantastic. I
got to tell you one more thing. When
you
mentioned Clint Walker, when I interviewed Clint Walker, I interviewed him like three times. First for the Lee Marvin book and then later about his career in general. But one of the first things I said to him, and I love that I got to tell him this, I said, you know that scene when Lee Marvin is goading you into stabbing him, and you lose it, and you go, stop pushing, and he goes nuts, and then Lee Marvin flips him. I said, when I saw that movie when I was a little kid, I was like 9 years old, you scared the hell out of me. That was frightening. And Clint Walker laughed, and he went, well, good. That means I did my job.
Yeah. Well, I was going to talk about Clint Walker. I'm glad you brought it up, because I feel like the fact that he's Native American is a little bit lost in the movie. And yes. I know in your book, it talks about how you're supposed to have a rain dance and all that.
Yep. And one of the other things that most fans of the movie always complain about is they never gave Clint Walker a death scene. You don't know how Posey died. Now, he definitely dies because the guy who's next to him, Bravos, actor named Al Mancini, they're in the machine gun nest together. Now, you see Al Mancini die, but they don't show Posey die. What they were going to do was what they did in the book, wherein Posey rips off his uniform, smears himself with war paint, and goes like, Rambo on everybody. Not everybody, the Nazis. And he did it in a rain dance, and he's just blowing people away until he gets blown away. Well, apparently, they decided to go with what Jim Brown did, and it took up more time on the film. And Clint Walker told me he was very disappointed. He had rehearsed a rain dance and he wanted to do it. But ultimately, they went with Jim Brown tossing those grenades down in the, the vent system.
Well, that's a big part of it, though. That's how all those explosions happen. And, all those people in the basement.
Right, it's important that they had showed that. But there are people who still think Posey didn't die because they didn't show him die. But he definitely died because when they do that crawl in the end, those who lost their lives, he's the last one they show. So he's definitely dead. Now, he doesn't die in the book. Matter of fact, in the novel, several more of the dozen survive than they do in the film. And Nathanson, even in the 80s, wrote a sequel to The Dirty Dozen called A Dirty Distant War, which, by the way, is a very, very good book. It's about our involvement in Vietnam, and it goes back to when World War II was still going on. So, and it's really well done. I was impressed with it. But the thing about what you mentioned a moment ago about Telly Savalas, one of the brilliant things about Telly Savalas in that movie, aside from how well he played the character, I was amazed to find out his character was actually three different characters in the book. There was a guy who was a sexual pervert, for lack of a better way to put it, I guess.
Sure.
Sexual psychopath. Another guy who was a religious fanatic. And another guy who was a Southern bigot. And they magically somehow put all three of those characters into Maggot. And you'd never know it was three different people. He played it like a religious, yeah, sexually perverse bigot.
Yeah, he's nuts. He's, yeah, nuts in that movie.
Yeah, and you know, they had to have one guy who, you know, try as they might, was unredeemable, and it was him.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, Savalas is great in that, and I've always liked Telly Savalas. I mean, if it wasn't for Maggot, that mission goes a lot smoother. Yeah, that's one thing that always pissed me off as a kid. I mean, he just goes nuts. I mean, you know, with him and Jim Brown upstairs.
I was just going to say, and who's the one who greases Maggot? It had to be Jim Brown.
Yep, Jim Brown.
Which I think was a nice thought. Well, story Jim Brown tells about right before he pulls all the pins on the grenades and he races to put them in the vents. Jim Brown asked Robert Aldrich before they shot that scene. He said, "Can I shoot a Nazi? Everybody else has gotten to shoot Nazis." And Aldrich goes, "You're going to blow them all up. Why do you want to shoot a Nazi?" And Jim Brown goes, "Because it looks cool if I shoot a Nazi." And Robert Aldrich goes, "Okay, fine. You can shoot a Nazi." And if you remember in the movie, that's exactly what he does. Before he sets up the grenade, there's a sniper shooting at him, and he looks up, shoots him, and the guy, swan dives on under the cobblestone. Yeah. So Jim Brown got to shoot a Nazi before he blew them all up.
One last thing I want to talk about, too. You know, you got me thinking this when I was thinking about the Maggot scene, because I was thinking about Maggot up standing guard when they brought the prostitutes in. Right. And I thought it was an interesting thing in the book. They talked about how originally it was going to be one prostitute. Uh-huh. And then, of course, the standards of practice, I guess, or whoever didn't like that idea, so they wanted to bring in multiple. I actually kind of agree, because multiple prostitutes is a party. One prostitute would have been a crime.
Exactly. Cool. Right. One of the things Nathanson said about that was Aldridge was a lot more generous than I was, coming up with eight prostitutes. And by the way, there was a line of dialogue they cut out, because while they're all partying, the character Pinkley, who's not that bright, Donald right. Sutherland, he turns to Bravos and he goes, "Hey, there's only eight women here." And the party's been going on for a while. And Bravos goes, "You just figured that out?" things like that.
Sure.
Made it fun.
So how did this movie do it? Oh, no, you said, I mean, this movie was very well received financially, correct? I mean,
it made a hell of a lot of money. It made so much money that, like I said, Lee Marvin, in tandem with another film that came out the same year, Point Blank came out the same year, a little later. So it gave a kind of 1-2 punch to his career, and he became the number one male box office star in America in 1967. Wow. Robert Aldrich made so much money that he was able to sell his percentage of the film, which was a goodly amount, and buy his own studio. He opened up his own studio. He already had his own production company, but this allowed him to buy a studio.
It didn't go well for him, did it?
I'm sorry?
That didn't go well for him over time, did it?
No, because of the choices of the films he decided to make. There were some of them have since become cult classics, but at the time that they released, they didn't do well at all. And so eventually he had to sell the studio. Now, Ken Hyman became the head of Warner Brothers Seven Arts. And it's because of him, as he said famously, he said, "I didn't become a producer because I'm a producer. I became a producer because I wanted to make good movies." Mm. And under his guidance, we got The Wild Bunch. We got, oh my God, so many great movies. He started the directing careers of Paul Newman when he greenlighted Rachel, his first film. Also, Paul Mazursky and Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice.
Oh, good movie, Bob and
Carol. Yeah, yeah. Now, not all of his movies succeeded, obviously. And eventually, I know Warner Brothers Seven Arts had to sell off a good part of what they were, and they became Time Warner. But when Ken Hyman was running the place, I thought he did a hell of a job. And it was, like I said, a direct result of the success of The Dirty Dozen. Jim Brown became the king of 70s blaxploitation films.
Yep.
And he was a movie stud, let's face it. So, Charles Bronson, he had an interesting thing happen with his career. Bronson stayed in Europe after he made The Dirty Dozen. And he had been toiling as a kind of a journeyman actor and filmed for as long as Lee Marvin. What happened was he had married Jill Ireland, and Jill Ireland advised him at that time. She advised him to make the films he never would have made otherwise. He had been asked to do all three of the previous Sergio Leone spaghetti westerns. He turned them all down. When he got the script to Once Upon a Time in the West, he didn't want to do that either. Jill right. Ireland said, Charlie, do it. You're missing a golden opportunity. She right. talked him into it. He did it. It's a great film. That movie played in Europe in major theaters for 7 years.
Did it really?
I mean, think about that. That's yeah. a hell of a run.
And then that's such a good movie, too. I love that.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah. And he proceeded to make a lot of other great Euro thrillers in Europe that put him on the map, made him a huge superstar all over the globe, except in America. He made Rider on the Rain, great movie, Farewell Friend, Someone Behind the Door. These are all great European-style thrillers, and they're so much fun to watch. And then when he came to this country, when he came back to America, he was making films that were kind of financed in Europe, but they mm-hmm. were American films. The Mechanic, The Valachi Papers.
Mr. Majestic.
Mr. Majestic was finally American financed. And he was okay. starting to make a name for himself with movies like that. Hard Times, another great movie. Then he made Death Wish.
Mm.
All bets were off. It changed right. his career, and he became a superstar from there on.
So, he made all those sequels. That's the downside. Right, yeah, yeah. Speaking Franchise. Of sequels, what do you think of the Dirty Dozen sequels? The made-for-TV movie?
Yeah, I don't like any of them. I think they missed the point. The problem with all of those films was that they emphasized the missions that they were all on and not the characters.
Right.
Because the original was, there was a mission, no doubt, but it was about the characters. There have never been characters like that in any movie at all. I mean, granted, there were some movies made even during the war itself where you had bad guys doing good things. Humphrey Bogart made a couple of movies where he played, they're silly movies, but he played gangsters who take on the, he played a gangster who takes on the Nazis.
Yeah.
A movie called All Through the Night, and he did it as an escaped convict from Devil's Island, Passage to Marseille. And there are a few, the Bowery Boys took on the Nazis. And
Abbott and Costello meet the Nazis?
No, but they often trained in Buck Privates and in the Navy. I mean, it was a common thing.
Yeah, and, very, very common.
But never in the history of bad guys doing good things, never had there been these violent convicts doing what they did. And keep in mind, they also drive home the point. They never once did it for the cause. They didn't give a damn about the Nazis. They didn't even know the Nazis. They never encountered them. They didn't know anything about them. They did it for pure survival and redemption. Nathanson was asked if he believes in redemption. He says, I don't know if there is such a thing or not, but I do believe in the effort. It's okay to make an effort to redeem yourself, but I don't know if it ever comes to pass. And that really shows through in the movie.
Yeah. I always thought Vladislav got redemption. Charles Bronson.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is, in the book, he's a very minor character. They made him a much bigger character in the film. And what's interesting is early on, you discover Vladislav did commit the crime, okay, that he was convicted for. But more importantly, his character is a professional soldier. Marvin even says to him, well, you were an officer once, and three lousy days. Right. And he sets up the end line in that scene too, at the end of the film.
Does?
He goes, I hate officers, all of them. And then what does he say at the end of the film? Killing generals can get to be a habit with me.
Yeah.
But he was a trained soldier, and his reasoning made sense. And it being the military, I'm surprised the military itself didn't take that under consideration when they court-martialed him. But it was Lee Marvin who explained it. Charles Bronson said, we were pinned down by the most murderous crossfire you ever saw. And this lover, he takes off with all the medical supplies on his back. The only way to stop him was to shoot him. Sure. And that's what Marvin says. Yeah, but you made one mistake. Yeah. Let somebody see you do it.
Let somebody see you do it. Yep.
Right. And obviously the entire unit saw him do it. So he had no choice.
Sure. Let's talk about... That's what the legacy of this movie in terms of all the other movies it's inspired. Because I feel like this inspired a ton of movies.
It still does.
Sure.
It wasn't that long ago that, 3-4 years ago, that Quentin Tarantino made that movie, Inglourious Basterds.
Sure.
So instead of them being although I think some of the characters did have a criminal history, but more importantly, he drove home the point that these guys are Jews. These are Jews, many of them Jewish immigrants who fled Europe when the Nazis invaded. And this is their chance to get back. And I thought it was a brilliant idea. I really do. I know a lot of people complain, oh, that ending was so stupid. He burned everybody in the theater. I mean, come on. If you really think that, I mean, because I had a friend of mine say, I pity any kid who has to do a school book report based on seeing Inglourious Bastard. And I said to him, what kid is going to be stupid enough to base history on a Quentin Tarantino movie? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I also love the idea that he did that because Tarantino saw the Dirty Dozen in a movie theater and it gets blown up, you know, the chateau gets blown up. So let's put all the Nazis in a movie theater and blow it up.
Sure.
You know, burn
sure.
it. It was, I thought it was brilliant symbolism.
He did a similar thing with, in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, kind of rewrote
yes, he did.
That ending as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love that ending.
Sure.
And it explains the title when people say, how come it's called that? Because it never happened. It's a fantasy. It's
right.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. This should have happened, but it didn't.
Yeah.
Also, James Gunn, who has become a superstar directing those Guardians of the Galaxy movies,
yeah.
he's a huge Dirty Dozen fan, and that's where he got the idea for that film. And I know Volume 3 is now the number one film in the country, and there has been talk off and on of him doing a reboot of the Dirty Dozen. I mean, the movie still resonates, and it might be considered old-fashioned now from the time it came out, but I personally don't think so. I don't think it's dated. I don't think it's old-fashioned in any way. And I know people who have seen it for the first time fairly recently and tell me, wow, what a great movie. It's like it was made yesterday, and I feel that way. But you can't say that about a lot of movies.
Sure. No, it holds up.
Yeah,
it holds up very well. I mean, it's still a really cool movie, you know?
Yeah, and you know, because I put in there, I read the memo from the censorship board that were, you know, fighting back and forth with Aldridge and Ken Hyman. But apparently, there's just a couple of what, for lack of a better word, anybody would call cuss words in the movie, which really weren't prevalent that much yet in film. But they're in there. Apparently, it was much, much worse. They had cut a lot out from what they had originally intended. And, excuse me, most of them were racial epithets about Jews, Italians, African-Americans. They had to minimize that. And there were also certain characters that were completely cut out because they had to do with the sexual relations they had with the main characters. John Reisman, the Lee Marvin character, had a girlfriend that was also in the book. And she was a barmaid. And he would see her and they would have relations, and they said, no, you can't have him do that. Take it out. And then there was a character that had an affair with Robert Ryan's character, Colonel Breed, and her name was Lady Margot. And she's an interesting character in the book, and she had been put into the movie script, but ultimately when the movie was running too long, she was entirely cut out. And that's a good thing because there was a sex scene there, too.
And
so
the
compromises that were reached, I think, were good ones.
Actually. Sure. It would have been her property they were on, right? Was that that her role?
Exactly right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. There's a great twist when you find out that not only was she having an affair with Colonel Breed, but she was also having an affair because she tries to get Reisman's sympathy and be haughty and going, I've sacrificed for this war more than anybody else. My husband was a flyer with the RAF, and he was shot down over Germany. And then turns out Reisman finds out her husband was shot down while she was having the affair with Colonel Breed.
Right? Mm-hmm.
And then you find out, too, Breed finds out that she's a spy for the Germans.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. That wasn't in the movie script, but it's definitely in the book.
Gotcha.
And she was spying for the Nazis.
Book.
Yeah.
Well, Dwayne,
it's interesting.
I appreciate you doing this, man. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you for having me, man. It was a lot of fun for me too.
So where like can we find the book? I know where I found it, but where can other people find it?
Oh, you mean this wonderful new tome that's available wherever books are sold. But if you don't want to wait, you can get it on Amazon.com as a hardcover, Kindle, or also it's in audio format, and also BarnesandNoble.com and in bookstores everywhere.
I
also
go ahead.
Also on the publisher's website, Kensington Press.
Ah, okay. I bought it at Barnes & Noble. So, so there you go. I was really excited because you and I had just kind of communicated on Facebook. And so I had to be at Barnes & Noble anyway. And
in the store or online?
Go ahead.
In the store or online?
No, in the store. Yeah, I live here in Franklin, Tennessee, and we have a nice big Barnes & Noble. My daughter has dance class right next to it, so oftentimes I'll drop her off at dance. I'll go hang out in Barnes & Noble for an hour. And you and I just communicated, and I was like, I wonder if that guy's book is in here. There it was, right in the new release section, New York Times bestselling author. I was like, all right. So I flipped through a few pages. Yeah, so I started reading it, and that's when I hit you back up on Facebook. I was like, let's do this.
Thank you so much. And I'm glad you're telling me this because, you know, as an author, we kind of live in a goldfish bowl. I don't really know what, you know, if stores are promoting it, what stores it's in. I checked the Barnes & Noble website of, you know, that might be the website, and it would tell me what stores are close to me. Now, there's one not too far from me, but they don't have the book. There's one about 20 miles from me, and it says it does have the book. Now, like I said, I'm in the dark. It's like a goldfish bowl. Yeah. And other than the publisher on occasion letting me know, and certainly Amazon letting authors know once a week, I have no idea how it's doing in sales. I think it's doing pretty good, but I'm not positive. So what you just told me, I love that.
Well, great. And I recommend people buy it, especially if you love the movie. I think it's great to, you know, what I did was I started reading the book. I got about halfway through, right until right to a point where they were casting it. Then I stopped, rewatched the movie, and then I finished the book. They go together so great, and it gives you a new appreciation for the movie.
And thank you for saying that.
So anyway, so it is Killing Generals, the making of The Dirty Dozen, the most iconic World War II movie of all time. Dwayne, thank you so much for being on Fan Check. Is there any social media, anything that people can follow you on?
Oh, yeah. I'm available on Facebook, and I promote the book throughout Facebook. Also Twitter. I'm on Twitter.
And what's your Twitter handle?
Too. At DwayneEpstein.com. Dwayne Epstein.
Sure. I'm not a big Twitter guy either, but all right, Dwayne. Well, hey, man, I appreciate you doing this. Let's hope we get a chance to talk soon.
Oh, me too. Thank you so much for having me. I had a ball.
Of course, man.